He says, when his reason is calm and pure, a man does not know how he will act when his dark desire overtakes him. A man is dazzled by his own wisdom and proud of his knowledge, but as soon as a little desire stirs in him, he forgets all his learning. Reason is like a trained dog who follows sedately in his master's footsteps until he sees a bitch.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today, we'll be reading My Quarrel with Hirsch Rasehner by Chaim Grade. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Today's story, My Quarrel with Hirsch Rasehner, was published in the 1951-52 Rosh Hashanah issue of the New York Yiddish periodical Yiddisher Kämpfer, The Jewish Militant. It was the first prose work of Chaim Grade, who until then was well known as a Yiddish poet. Grade had turned to prose because the ideas he had to get off his chest could best be expressed in a form like that of the Talmudic disputations of the many years that he had spent studying in a yeshiva. Writing this story as a work of autobiographical fiction, he called the version of himself by his yeshiva name. Boys were often called by where they came from, so he is Chaim from Vilna, Chaim Vilner. The resulting work was so powerful that unlike most Yiddish writing, which remained confined to those who knew the language, this story was immediately translated into English by Milton Himmelfarb, one of the finest American Jewish intellectuals of the day, and published in Commentary magazine, where it drew a lot of attention. Mein Krieg mit Hirsch Rasehner, Krieg being more precisely a war or battle than a quarrel, takes the form of an extended argument between two Jewish men in their late 30s who in 1948 meet up accidentally in the Paris metro, spend the rest of the day talking, and then separate, unlikely ever to meet up again. Described this way, it may sound like a new wave French film in which philosophy students from the Sorbonne debate the relative merits of Kierkegaard and Jean-Paul Sartre. But it is not quite that. The two men, Chaim Vilner and Hirsch Rasehner, had been close friends back in their teens in Poland, when they were both students in a yeshiva of the Musar movement, until Chaim quit both the yeshiva and the religious way of life to become a Yiddish poet. The times they saw each other after that left them angrier than when they had parted. Then came the Second World War. Chaim survived as a refugee in the Russian interior, Hirsch in German concentration camps. They are wonderfully surprised to recognize each other again in Paris in 1948. And what happens now? To explore this question, Grade begins his story back in 1937 in the Polish city of Bialystok, where the Musar Yeshiva was located. He tells us that he, Chaim, had gone back to Bialystok for a visit, not to the yeshiva, but to give a public reading from his first book of poems. Though some of his former classmates, against the orders of the head of the yeshiva, come to hear him, and others visit him secretly, he is disappointed that Hirsch Rasehner is not among them. And then when he suddenly does run into Hirsch, his former friend, wastes no time in telling him off for going after his lusts, for selfishly seeking fame, for wanting nothing more than to see his name at the top of a book jacket. Chaim would much have preferred to resume friendlier contact, but now, attacked, he strikes back just as harshly, telling Hirsch that his piety is a form of false pride and that he lives off the work of the poor women who support the yeshiva. The Yiddish term for secular is weltlich, or worldly, and there is no common ground between the deeply observant Jew and the worldly one. 2 years later, in 1939, the two have another chance meeting, this time in Vilna, under much more dangerous political conditions. Hitler had by then invaded Germany from the west and Stalin from the east, and although Vilna was now formally under the Lithuanians, Soviet agents are everywhere present. The yeshiva had moved from Bialystok to Vilna to escape Soviet control, but everyone knows that the secret police have been rounding up opponents of the regime. Hersch is wary of even speaking to Chaim, who was close to the left. But when he sees how unhappy Chaim looks, he takes his chances. "Well, Chaim," Hersch says to me quietly, "are you satisfied now? Is this what you wanted?" I tried to smile and answer just as quietly, "Hersch, just because you consider me treif doesn't mean that they consider me kosher." Chaim tries to explain that he bears no more responsibility for Soviet communism than Hersch does for him, Chaim. But that is the wrong thing to say. Hersch believes that all Jews are responsible for one another. So he responds, "You're wrong, Chaim. I do bear responsibility for you. And by implication, so does Chaim bear responsibility for the Soviets." These two angry encounters serve as the background for the post-Second World War reunion of Chaim and Hersch in Paris in 1948. All around them, Parisians are going about their business, but from the moment the two recognize each other, they are in a world of their own. Both are products of a yeshiva education guided by a strict set of Jewish teachings known as Musar that tries to forge an ethical personality through carefully circumscribed restraints of the appetites and the ego. By now, they have witnessed evils that Musar teachings could not have imagined and experienced equally unimaginable personal losses. Each expects that the other must have changed as a result. When Hersch tells Chaim that he had been in a concentration camp in Latvia and that he was now head of a yeshiva in Germany, Chaim is astonished. "Really? Who are your students?" he asks. Hersch smiles. "Do you think that the Holy One is an orphan? There are still boys, praised be the Almighty, who study Torah." When Chaim wonders how a pious Jew can still go on believing in God after what they have witnessed, Hersch cites a well-known work of Jewish religious law. One is obliged to offer a blessing over the bad as over the good. How else can one say that one believes in God except through acceptance of his judgment over our own? Hersch says that he was able to save the group of boys who are now his students through the power of his faith, and that is how he is gathering students from as far away as Morocco. In fact, one can feel from the way he now speaks that he is more confident in his belief, more generous in his friendship. Vilner, for his part, teases Rasener for sounding just like the founder of Chabad, the sweeter branch of Hasidic Judaism that goes out into the world to embrace fellow Jews. Rasener takes no offense. "For you who are on the outside, Hasidism and Musar are just two opposing points of view, and the first thing you notice about them is how they differ. But for those who observe and practice Jewishness, hitten op Yiddishkeit lemaise, they are one and the same. If the rabbis once fought over Hasidism and Musar, it was because they were afraid that the new path would draw Jews away from strict observance. But actually, they both strengthen Judaism, and their dispute is long forgotten. There is only one Torah. It all depends on how you approach it. When I feel that I am slackening in the observance of a law, I study the code of laws in the Shulchan Aruch. And when I feel overpowered in the struggle of life, I study Musar. And when Musar leads me too far into gloom and seclusion and tears me away from the community of Israel and love for my fellow Jews, then I turn to Hasidism." Far from weakening Hersch's faith, the great destruction has intensified his love of God and Torah, and to it has added affection for the community of his fellow Jews and the language to express it. But Hersch also has something much more forceful to say. Chaim Vilner may wonder how someone can still believe in God as though he were holding the Almighty responsible for letting evil happen. But Hirsch asks the harsher question, how can you still believe in man? Look at what became of the grandeur of Europe. He is not talking just about Hitler and the Nazis, not about anti-Semites who murdered the Jews, but about Chaim's idea that he could become an enlightened and better person without the discipline of halachic observance. In the rest of the story, Hirsch makes the most powerful case against Western Enlightenment that I know of in modern Jewish literature. Most Yiddish literature and culture had grown out of a belief in modern liberal ideas, which Grade shared. His writing was an expression of that belief. But though Grade is the creator of both characters, and though he speaks as Chaim Vilner, he gives Hirsch what many believe to be the stronger voice of the debate. And I believe that Grade wrote this work so that he could say through Rasener all the things that he could not say as Chaim Grade. Thus, when Vilner claims that the great writers broaden our understanding and expand our sympathies for our fellow man, including for the wicked who cannot overcome their desires, Hirsch is outraged. For shame, Chaim! How can you speak such rot when all that's left of the Vilna Gaon's study house are its charred walls? Those artists of yours, those poets who sang the praises of their emperors, were these masters of yours ever bothered that their patron, the king, could massacre a whole city with its women and children and steal everything they had so that he could buy them off, these masters, with that gold? If the writer can make excuses for the sinner, for the man who exults in his evil, then as far as Hirsch is concerned, all your scribbling is an abomination. Condemn the wicked man. Condemn the glutton and drunkard. You say he can't help himself? He has to help himself. Now, arguments of this kind about the failure of the arts to instill goodness had been made by others, including Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But Hirsch was making it with Jewish authority and backed up by what Europe had just witnessed. Chaim, in defense of Western humanism, points to the statues on the facade of the Hotel de Ville, invoking the great geniuses of arts and science who have disseminated wisdom. In turn, Hirsch acknowledges that he learned a lot about those impressive thinkers from some of the learned people in the concentration camp. The school of Athens taught reason, he admits, but did they really live as they taught? Or did their systems remain just that? He says, you must understand once and for all that when his reason is calm and pure, a man does not know how he will act when his dark desire overtakes him. A man is dazzled by his own wisdom and proud of his knowledge, but as soon as a little desire stirs in him, he forgets all his learning. Reason is like a trained dog who follows sedately in his master's footsteps until he sees a bitch. A man can justify whatever he wants to do. Is he saying the opposite of what he just said a while ago? He'll tell you that he was wrong then. And if he lets you prove to him that he wasn't wrong then, he'll shrug and say, when I feel like doing something, I can't be Aristotle. Summing up, Hirsch sweepingly identifies the evils of Western civilization as the consequence of the sort of intellectual self-reliance embraced by Chaim. So there came in the West a booted ruler with a little mustache, and in the East a booted ruler with a big mustache, and both of them together struck the wise man to the ground and he sank into the mud. In short, reason and intelligence actually work against goodness. That is why, quote, a man should choose between good and evil only as the law chooses for him, unquote. The Torah wants the best for us. Living by its law doesn't mean consulting a book. It requires developing the habits that constitute a life of goodness and generosity. That is why one has to train oneself in self-restraint and self-discipline, just as Jewish religious law teaches. If Hirsch is allowed to demolish secular liberalism, does Vilner make a parallel argument against Haredi Judaism? Actually, his strongest case against Musser comes not in their argument, but when one of Rasener's students turns up looking for his rabbi. This boy is rude to Vilner, dogmatic and shrill, the way Hirsch was back in Bialystok. "Is this what you teach?" he scolds Rasener when they are alone. "Hatred and scorn for the whole world?" Qualities of rigid narrowness that had softened in Hirsch are evident in his disciple, somewhat weakening the image of inclusivity that he tries to convey. As the back and forth continues, Hirsch introduces one point of agreement. Just suppose, he asks, that a huge meteor was approaching the Earth and we knew it was about to destroy the planet. Would we have to make peace with today's Germans because all of humankind was about to be extinguished? Yes or no? No, Chaim agrees. No, we would not be required to make peace with today's Germans. Chaim later pleads with Hirsch to recognize that there were righteous people among the nations who had selflessly helped Jews at great personal risk. But the indictment of Hitler's Germany is there, immovable and implacable. With the approach of evening, both men realize that their conflict is not going to be resolved. Far from disappointing the reader, Grade means this to be the story's affirmation, its victory. The wholesale destruction of Polish Jewry, the ruin of its yeshiva culture, the worst that the enemies of the Jews had ever done, have in no way affected the essential argument at the heart of Judaism. The argument that began in Bialystok and went underground under the Soviets has survived Hitler and Stalin and withstands the temptations of Paris. Judaism's insistence on obedience to the law never proved its moral worth as definitively as in the pan-European attempt to destroy it. Chaim will not return to the yeshiva, but he knows that he must stay within the orbit of its teachings. Among the many interpretations of this story, and there will surely be many more in the years to come, is the film The Quarrel by Joseph Telushkin and David Brandis. When they transposed it into this different medium, they had to develop aspects of the two characters that are conspicuously missing in the original text. After all, on first meeting after those fateful 9 years since 1937, they must have asked about the fate of their families, what each had been through, what had happened to their classmates. How could they have avoided lingering over their common past? By fleshing out such memories, including of the niggun, the melody that the head of their yeshiva used to sing, the film supplies the affective elements that touch us emotionally and bring us to tears. And this, in turn, alerts us to all that Grade's story leaves out. The story's stubbornly exclusive emphasis on the moral question, on what ensures the moral life, shows us the extent to which Grade, no less than his former classmate, is still equally the product of Musser. He concludes by asking Hirsch not to wall himself up, not to exclude him, Chaim, from the ongoing debate. Indeed, from then on, Grade wrote voluminous novels and stories in which he recreated the Jewish society in which he had been raised and that was consumed by such questions. Obviously, in that Jewish world as well, there had been both good and evil. But whereas Judaism had gone to extraordinary lengths to try to reduce and contain wrongdoing, Europeans in the surrounding societies were going in the opposite direction. At that point in the historical trajectory of Judaism's encounter with the world, Grade knew that of his two fictional protagonists, Hirsch could speak the more confidently about how best to ensure a moral life, and so he speaks it for him. I taught this story several times over a number of years, never satisfied with the available translations. So with due appreciation for the work of my predecessors, I recently translated it anew and published it in a new bilingual edition, letting readers who are fortunate enough to read Yiddish enjoy it for the first time in book form. In closing this second series of Stories Jews Tell, I hope that this work, like all the others in these podcasts, will form a living part of the body of Jewish literature that sustains us and that we share with our neighbors. For now, and until very soon, I hope, happy reading.